Good morning, Your Honor. My name is David Mills. I represent Media General, the appellant in this case. I've saved 3 minutes for rebuttal. This is an appeal of a summary judgment decision in a securities fraud case that Media General filed in 1998. In 2003, the district court dismissed this case once before based on a finding that there was insufficient evidence of materiality to go to a jury. This court reversed that in 2004 and remanded. And on August 13, 2007, the court found there was insufficient evidence on summary judgment, found there was insufficient evidence to go to a jury on three issues. First, whether there was a misrepresentation or omission of material fact. Second, whether there was reasonable reliance or due diligence by Media General. And third, whether there was evidence of loss causation or proof of damages. That's the ruling that's the subject of this appeal. The relevant facts here, I think, are best described in the context of the misrepresentation argument that we've made. The record establishes the following facts, among others. This is based on a deal that occurred in July. On July 19, 1996, Media General entered into a merger agreement, essentially to purchase the stock of Park Communications from the sellers Tomlin and Knapp for $710 million. Each seller was to receive over $107 million in profit. There was an interim period between the time the merger agreement was signed and the date of the closing because FCC approvals were required for this merger. On September 20th, during the interim period, September 20th, 1996, a former employee of Park from the radio division, not the division that was being purchased, wrote a letter to Media General notifying Media General that he had a severance dispute with Park Communications for $139,000. Media General's controller immediately contacted the president of Park, Tom Thomas, who was representing the sellers in this transaction, along with Stephen Burr and Eckert Siemens, the lawyers for the sellers. On October 20, and Thomas explained that this was a severance dispute, a contract dispute, and nothing more, and he was attempting to settle that matter. On October 23rd, the sellers, because they were so concerned that Prusader was trying to upset this deal with Media General, wrote a letter to Mr. Prusader and his counsel, trying to scare off Prusader from making any further contact with Media General, threatening tortious interference if he did so. On November 9th, Mr. Prusader had a new attorney, and on November 9th, 1996, his new counsel sent a letter to Stephen Burr, the counsel for Park, for the sellers, threatening a multimillion-dollar lawsuit. The claims included fraud, RICO, breach of fiduciary duty, and a number of other claims. He also claimed a right to ownership of some of the stock that Media General was going to be acquiring and demanded $3 million in settlement. On November 12th, a few days later, Mr. Burr faxed that letter and the draft complaint, which is attached to the letter, to his client Thomas, to his client clients Tomlin and Knapp, and also to Tom Thomas. He commented in that fax that Prusader has, quote, upped the ante considerably. Meanwhile, on that same day, November 12th, the controller, Steve Dickinson from Media General, was at Park Communications headquarters making inquiries about matters that were relevant to this transaction, asked about the Prusader matter, and was not given any kind of an update about the Prusader matter or the additional claims. During this entire period of time, during this interim period of time, Dickinson, the CFO, Marshall Morton, Lenny Bax, the outside counsel, repeatedly asked Thomas and Burr, the principals who were handling the Prusader matter directly, they were the folks who had the most knowledge about it, what the status of it was, and each time they were told it was a simple severance dispute and the new claims that Prusader.
Why didn't you all ask for the response to the audit letter?
There was no need for that. The audit letter was a period of time that ended on September 30th, 1996.
Is that the normal business practice in closing a deal, that you don't ask for the response to the audit letter or the draft financial statements? Is that normal business practice?
We had financial statements.
Is that normal business practice?
It is, because there's a difference between what the court conflated here were two periods of time. Prior to the signing of the merger agreement in the first place, before there was a signing of any contract, there was a significant period of due diligence, and audit letters were obtained, and all the working papers, contracts, ERISA matters, all kinds of things were done as a matter of due diligence. Armies of lawyers are sent to do those things. That's to determine what kind of a contract is going to be signed, to negotiate the price and the other terms of the deal. Once the deal is signed, between that time and the closing is a different period of time. During that period of time, the party's conduct is governed by the contract. That contract required the disclosure of material adverse litigation. There was an obligation on the seller's part to disclose this information. Whatever was going out to the lawyers who were handling litigation.
And you knew there was an audit letter
No, we did not. We knew there was an audit going on. We had no reason to think that there was a specific audit letter. This is not one of those cases that the court relied on. Now, we're getting to reasonable reliance and due diligence here. Where the court relied on a number of cases that dealt with situations where the buyer actually had the document or it was a public document, a statute that was in the Royal American case, or a private placement memorandum, which was actually provided by a broker in one of the other cases, where they simply didn't read it. This is not that situation here. Media General did not have those documents and had no reason to ask for them. They were drilling down much further. In fact, if you think about the purpose of an audit response letter, it's to notify the buyer that, gee, maybe there's something you might want to inquire further about. And in fact, we were beyond that stage. Media General was at a point where it was asking the principals directly about that exact matter. And it was being told, and it wasn't a situation where the sellers were saying, you better ask someone else. I'm not really handling that matter. Thomas was handling that matter. He was negotiating it. He was describing the details of the settlement demand that had been rejected. It wasn't a situation where Media General had any reason to go beyond that, especially for an audit period that was going to be ending on September 30th, 1996, not up through the date of closing. The obligation to get later material was a part of the contract, and they were asking about it every step of the way. With regard to the negotiations at the closing table, there's no question that the Prusader matter was still on the open items list throughout this entire period of time. Media General never stopped asking about it, was completely diligent about it. The parties negotiated a laundry list of other items, several of which were much less significant than the Prusader matter, at least the $139,000 matter. There was an unaccrued vacation for $29,000. Unrecorded insurance claim liability of $94,000, acquisition of the seller's cars for $79,000. They wanted it for $79,000. It was settled for $71,000. They were negotiating over $8,000 at the closing table. This is in the joint appendix at 507 to 512. Media General continued to ask about it. Burns, one of the lawyers for Media General, asked Thomas and Burr, tell us about the Prusader matter, and they only described the severance dispute. The deal closed on January 7th. In misrepresentation, first, I'd like to say that the court, in our view, ignored the affirmative misrepresentations and treated this solely as an omissions case. But there were affirmative misstatements. There's no question also that the testimony was quite clear. Thomas and Burr were both in the room. It was the same meeting, the same conversation. Both spoke in response to the questions about Prusader. You can find all of this information at the Joint Appendix 894, at 684, 799, and also in the summary judgment opposition that we filed below in the appendix of deposition excerpts at tab 9 in Mr. Mahoney's deposition at page 67. Thomas affirmatively described the Prusader matter in a way that was false. Burr said nothing new is going on. That's a false affirmative statement. He said the maximum Prusader was asking for was 139. False statements. But even if you look at this as an omissions case, the court found that because the court credited the testimony that the defendants believed Media General was already aware of the expanded claims, and because of that, their statement wasn't misleading under the circumstances. That's the basis of the court's ruling. That's not logical, we submit with respect. If the defendants thought that Media General was aware of all of Prusader's claims, then when the question was asked, tell us about the Prusader matter, why did the court infer that the only reasonable response was to assume that Media General was only asking about the severance dispute? Certainly that a jury could conclude that the question asked about much more than that, even assuming exactly what the court assumed were the circumstances in this case. That question had to mean tell us about all of Prusader's claims. But this, in any event, the question of what the defendants believed goes to scienter. It doesn't go to whether there was a misrepresentation or the context in this case. And if you look at the closing at that time, there's no way that anyone at that closing table could have thought that Media General was aware of the expanded claims. Media General asked about Prusader repeatedly. The defendants were afraid that that Prusader matter, the expanded claims, were going to ruin their deal. They scared them off. No defendant ever disclosed the claims to Media General. No defendant ever said, I don't know about them, asked someone else. At the closing, they negotiated about all kinds of other things, and not a single question, not one, by Media General about these expanded claims. And they represented much more exposure, millions of dollars in exposure with all kinds of additional claims related to a different business that Media General would have had to know more, much more about. There's no way that Media General wouldn't have asked about those claims if it was aware of them. In any event, even assuming that they had, that even assuming the plaintiffs believed Media General knew about those claims, it doesn't go to whether there was a misrepresentation. The fact is Media General clearly did not know, and the defendants misled them anyway. Well, and all of these are jury questions. I'm sorry.
Let me ask you about loss causation.
Yes.
Okay. You make actually two claims, one a 10b-5 and one a common law claim. And my question is whether you think that the claim that you're making here actually meets the standard for loss causation articulated in the federal cases, in other words, the 10b-5 cases.
I do, Your Honor. Loss causation requires proof that the loss, the harm, was directly related to the defendant's conduct, the economic harm. There was a reasonable probability that the fraud actually accomplished the result that it was intended to bring about.
Well, that's what I want to ask you about.
Okay.
So let me follow up here. Because as I read those cases, they're saying something a little different, and I would articulate it this way, that what the cases really say is that the loss has to result from that representation or omission. In other words, that there has to be a specific causal nexus. You seem to be arguing for a much more general standard.
I think it's the same standard, Your Honor, and this is the way I would explain that. The question is, can you draw that connection between the fraud and the harm? There has to be a causal connection. I agree with that. That is the standard. As this court said in the last opinion, a reasonable jury could decide that had Media General known about the expanded claims at the time of closing, the terms of the merger would have been different. And as the Second Circuit explained in the AUSA life insurance case, that can be shown by showing that the fraud prevented the plaintiffs from exercising their rights and remedies under the agreement. And that's exactly what happened here. Media General got stuck with the expanded litigation, and that the cost of that is part of the damages, and there's no challenge to that. But Media General also would have renegotiated the purchase price or walked away.
Before you go on, what is it in our prior opinion to which you're...
I'm talking about the discussion at page 870. Where the court was talking about materiality and whether there was sufficient evidence of materiality to go to a jury, and the court found that that there was sufficient evidence for a jury to conclude that the terms of this closing would have been different. And what I'm arguing today is that the price term also would have been different.
But you couldn't have walked away. The merger agreement says if there's I'm looking at 9.1C, upon a material breach of this merger agreement on the part of the company set forth in this merger agreement, which has not been cured, you have to give them a chance to cure. If you had seen the audit letter, right, if they'd given you the audit letter, you then go to them and say, what's this expanded claim? And then they have a right to cure, which is easily done here through indemnification, right?
No,
you couldn't have walked away from this.
No, if they deprived us of that opportunity.
Isn't it true? Wait, no, you couldn't have walked away from this. You have to give them an opportunity to cure. Isn't that right?
It's correct if it's something that could be cured, but they didn't tell us until the very day of closing.
What I'm going back to is you said that had you known the price, had you known about the expanded claim, you could have walked away. And I'm just saying that's false. That's not so. You would have presented to them and given them an opportunity to cure. If they couldn't have cured, then you can walk away. They could easily cure here, right? They're indemnifying you.
I
wouldn't have agreed to that? Your clients wouldn't have agreed to indemnification?
I don't know that our clients would have agreed to indemnification because at that point in the closing, they had been lying to us for 2 months. And one of the big problems here was when you're dealing with sellers who are not honest with you, and that was a significant issue for Media General, that makes a difference in the terms of the closing. All these deals are based on the honesty of the parties that you're dealing with. And in this case, the $10 million is specifically tied to that. We have evidence in this case. Maybe that's not common to have evidence of a specific amount of damages like that, but we actually have evidence in this case that the amount of the purchase price was increased by $10 million.
That's an oral agreement, though, right?
I'm not asking to enforce it as a contract, Your Honor. I'm simply saying it's evidence of how we know that how much of the purchase price would have been decreased. Mm-hmm. And Media General would have decreased it by $10 million. based on that. And that's clear and unequivocal testimony in the record. My time has expired.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Kate Stetson. I represent two of the appellees in this matter, Mr. Tomlin and Mr. Thomas, but I'm arguing on behalf of all of the appellees this morning. Mr. Mills began his argument by pointing out that this is an appeal on summary judgment. That's right. But before a plaintiff gets to take its case to a jury, the plaintiff needs to show that there are relevant material disputes on every element of his claim. And the district court found that two of those elements were deficient here and granted summary judgment. The first goes to the misstatement or omission issue, and the second goes to due diligence. And with that, Judge Griffith, I'd like to pick up on your question about the audit response letter. It absolutely was standard industry practice, and that's not disputed, for lawyers engaged in a substantial transaction like this one to review the audit response letters. We know that, among other things, from the partner at Coopers & Lybrand responsible for running this audit at Joint Appendix 1063 and 1065. He makes the point that this is standard industry practice in any major transaction to look at an audit response letter setting
forth. But even so, that doesn't relieve these gentlemen from giving a fulsome response to the question when they're asked what's going on with the Crusader claim, right? I mean, we need to, on summary judgment, you need to credit the plaintiff's version of events here, right? And under the plaintiff's version of events, your client did not give a fulsome answer.
I think the problem, Judge Griffith, is that the Media General has been unable, in part due to the passage of time, in great part due to their failure to contemporaneously record any of these
desultory inquiries. You know, may be lacking, but as I read the deposition testimony, there's little doubt in my mind that the version of events that they're telling is we asked about the Crusader claim and they didn't tell us anything about the expanded claim.
Well, let's go straight to what Media General touts is its best evidence about these omissions or misrepresentations, which is, as Mr. Mills just pointed you to, Joint Appendix 894, and I point you further to 895 and 896, because this contains absolutely the heart of the problem with what Media General is trying to put forward, and it points up why you always look at documents and you don't just rely on desultory inquiries that can be interpreted different ways. It would be a jury question, I absolutely grant you, if what you had in this record is a statement from one of the park officials, this case that Mr. Crusader is only asking for $139,000. If Media General understood that was actually said, and you had a park lawyer saying, no, I just said the value was $139,000, this was a negotiation and I was ascribing a value to it. What you see on page 896 is a concession from Mr. Mahoney, who is the general counsel for Media General, when asked the follow-up question, can you tell me what words either Mr. Burr or Mr. Thomas said that led you to an understanding that the $139,000 was the maximum he was asking for, as opposed to an understanding that $139,000 was the most he'd ever be entitled to? Answer, I do not recall the specific word. That is the problem that the district court identified as warranting summary judgment. If you don't know what the misrepresentation was,
let me back up. I mean, on line two, and are you telling me now that you came away with an understanding that Mr. Burr was indicating that $139,000 was the maximum that Mr. Burr was asking for? Answer, Crusader was asking for. Question, Mr. Crusader was asking for? Answer, yes.
Follow-up question, but can you tell me what words were used that led you to that understanding? That's the problem, is that nobody, not Mr. Mahoney, not Mr. Burns, not Mr. Baxt, nobody who was listening to what Mr. Thomas and Mr. Burr were saying during these closing negotiations, which I remind you are over the value of certain line items in this major deal, nobody is able to say, they told me that it was a $139,000 claim. And in fact,
I'm sorry, that still doesn't seem to respond to their claim is that they just ask, you know, what is new? Is anything new happening there? Whether you knew exactly what the amount would be or what they were actually entitled to, it seems to me that the potential of all these other claims would be something new.
This, you're right, Judge Brown, but the problem is this feeds into the other independent basis for summary judgment, and that is the failure of due diligence. Media General undisputedly had available to it the audit response letter, and I didn't hear Mr.
You can't be saying that the fact that that information is out there somewhere means that the principals can simply not tell the truth. That cannot be.
Oh, no, I'm not saying that at all. I'm not saying that at all. And it's not just that the information was out there somewhere. It's that it was out there in an audit being prepared by Coopers, with whom Media General had worked closely, and whom Media General knew as early as September 30th was working on an audit for, among other reasons, Media General's own benefit.
I understand. Let me say, okay, maybe you get the best of this argument that the information was available, and if they had looked for it, they could have found it. But what I'm asking you is, assuming that they asked the principals at the closing, is anything new? And nobody responded with anything about that audit letter. Are you saying that they would still have a reliance problem?
Oh, yes, I think they do have a reliance problem, because at the time of the closing, January 6th and 7th, 1997, this audit response letter has been out there for over a month. So when Mr. Burr says, and this is something that Mr. Mills pointed out as well, nothing new is going on, that statement was made, and the district court correctly found it to have been made, on the undisputed assumption, as Mr. Burr put it in his deposition, that it was inconceivable to him that these experienced lawyers in this $710 million transaction hadn't seen that audit response letter. So between December 4th, 1996, and January 7th or 6th, 1997, nothing new had gone on. It was the same as reported in the audit response letter. It was the same as reported in the draft consolidated financial statement for Media General's, being prepared for Media General's benefit by Coopers and Lybrand. That information was out there just as if it had been sitting on the table at the closing negotiations. The negotiations are the point where the due diligence is presumed to have been performed. And one of the fundamental items, in fact, one of Media General's lawyers, Mr. Piper, back in June of 96, called an audit response letter a basic item. It's a basic item that you look at when you're performing an audit of
I seem to remember that there was some negotiation at the time of the closing. Am I right about this, that they negotiated over that $139,000 as an offset or something like
they
that?
They did, okay. Yes.
And you don't think that the fact that that's all they negotiated for would have given them a clue that they weren't aware of this?
No, I don't think that, for a couple reasons, Your Honor. The first is that what they negotiated for at closing, and you can see this in the First Amendment to the Merger Agreement, a Joint Appendix 452, was that if anything got paid in excess of $139,000, the two shareholders of Park reserved the right to contest that as a current liability of the company. So that at least suggests that the parties contemplated the possibility, however remote, that Media General would pay more than $139,000. Also, at the time, remember, it wasn't just the audit response letter that was available to Media General had they asked for it. It was the draft consolidated financial statement, which you can find at Joint Appendix 472, which included the assertion that management believes that the outcome of such claims will not have a material adverse effect on the company's financial position. So given what was out there, given the fact that the audit response letter had reported this information, given the management statement and the draft consolidated financial statement that it wasn't believed to have any material adverse effect, the fact that the parties negotiated for the maximum severance to which this man could possibly be entitled, and remember, Park thought that he was entitled to zero, so $139,000 is a pretty decent deal for Media General, all things considered, plus expressly contemplated the possibility that the claim would settle, any claims would settle for more than $139,000. And that's expressly recorded in Joint Appendix 452. I think it was completely possible, given the understanding that Burr and his side of the table walked into the negotiations, that the other side had done their homework in this enormous deal, that that was the, that was a perfectly appropriate understanding to have been reached in with a claim of this immateriality. Let me turn briefly, if I may, to Judge Brown, your question about the loss causation issue. You are precisely right. The standard that is used in loss causation, and loss causation has been described as kind of an exotic name for proximate cause. The standard is whether the misrepresentation caused actual economic loss. And the problem that Media General has run into is that its claim, first of all, surfaced about 5 years after its complaint. This claim for $10 million is the one I'm homing in on. And since it surfaced in July of 2002, has continued to evolve. If you look at the statements in the July 2002, I believe it's the second amended response to some interrogatories in which this $10 million claim is first mentioned, it is framed as an agreement. And you heard Mr. Mills again today characterize it as an agreement that was struck before the July 1996 merger agreement, that for an extra $10 million, the parties promised to be on their best behavior. But of course, as Mr. Mahoney testified, there's nothing in the agreement that records that separate consideration. And there's an integration clause in Section 10.4 of the agreement that expressly says that there are no other agreements, oral or written, and that any such agreements are superseded by the merger. So what Media General appears to now have done is to evolve its claim towards one having more to do with an assertion of loss of value of Park at the time of the closing. Here is the problem with that move. You have testimony from Mr. Morton that the $10 million claim has nothing to do with the value of Park. Joint Appendix 954. The $10 million doesn't go to the value of Park. Joint Appendix 987, which is an October 2002 letter from one of the Media General attorneys to one of the Park attorneys. Media General is not deriving the $10 million figure from any reduction in cash flow, profits, or revenues arising from the expanded Crusader claims. The $10 million is based on an agreement to pay that additional amount in exchange for good faith. That agreement, of course, whether or not they pled contract, it certainly sounds like contract, and it's not a contract claim. So when you ask the next question, where does the $10 million come from? If it's not a contract agreement, where did they get this number? It could have been a dollar. It could have been $709 million. The $10 million isn't tethered to any reality in this case. What the plaintiff apparently is trying to do at this point is to suggest that if they'd known about this frivolous set of claims, they could have used that information to basically exact a little more leverage, to exact a little more concessions from the other side. That's not actual loss. That is not loss causation. That's wishful thinking. In order for this $10 million number to have any relevance in the real world, it has to be shown to have been a real-world loss. And the plaintiff simply hasn't, in either theory, whether you're talking about contract or this sort of loose valuation argument that they seem to be tending toward, it simply hasn't linked up that issue. So just to return back to the merits briefly, the due diligence argument clearly is one that Media General will find it difficult to overcome, because just like Brown versus E.F. Hutton, just like Banca Kremi, just like Hirsch versus DuPont, and just like Zobrist, all of which were decided on summary judgment with the exception of Zobrist, which was reversed on a jury verdict for plaintiff. Each of those circumstances involved information that was available to the plaintiffs and that the plaintiffs nevertheless failed to consult. In just these circumstances, both in Banca Kremi and E.F. Hutton and in Brown, Hirsch versus DuPont, the Court of Appeals concluded that due diligence had been lacking. When a sophisticated businessman knows and it is undisputed that these people knew that these audit reports were being prepared and that Coopers was working on statements for its benefit, when a businessman knows that there is information out there and nonetheless fails to consult it, he is the one who is presumed to have constructive knowledge of that information. Media General had the opportunity to consult these reports. It failed to take it. It cannot now claim fraud as a result of its own lapses. If there are no further questions.
Thank you, Ms. Benson. Give you 2 minutes. If you need it.
Just a couple of quick points, Your Honor. First of all, with regard to the standard industry practice, that is rebutted testimony. Mr. Gregory was not admitted as an expert on that issue, and there's ample evidence in the testimony by several witnesses from Media General that this was not required, it was not part of their standard practice, and that, in fact, they were drilling down much more deeply than getting an incomplete draft audit. I would also point out that the cases that Ms. Stetson just mentioned, Royal American Managers, the plaintiff simply didn't read a statute that was made aware, he was made aware of. In Bank of Creamy, the plaintiff disregarded its own expert's advice. A bank hired three investment professionals and didn't follow their own advice. In Zobrist, there was actual possession of the private placement memorandum and it was not read. And in Brown, there was also publicly available prospectus that the broker provided. With regard to this red herring about the idea that the amendment to the merger agreement contemplated something beyond the $139,000, the testimony here was that the defendants insisted on that provision to prevent Media General from paying an excessive amount to Mr. Prusader and then claiming it out of the $1.5 million escrow that was set aside in the closing. That's found in the joint appendix at 874 and 75 and at 1018 and 1019 and also in Mr. Burns' testimony. It is not undisputed that the defendants walked into this closing thinking that Media General was aware of the expanded claims, and certainly, as I mentioned before, they could not possibly have continued to believe that once the closing unfolded and Media General asked nothing about these expanded claims. I see that my time has expired. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Mills. Ms. Stetson, thank you. Case is submitted.